The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on June the 2nd and is entitled, New Capitol Jewish Museum Connects the Past to the Present in Downtown D.C., by Adele M. Banks, Washington. The oldest synagogue building in the nation's capital has become the anchor of a new museum, highlighting the history of Jewish people in the region. The Capitol Jewish Museum is set to open its doors to the public on June 9. We're standing next to the simple, original Yudas Israel Synagogue, which has been merged into the striking, magnificent building, said Esther Safran Foer, board president of the museum and a long-term member of the synagogue, now located about 4 miles away from its former downtown D.C. location. Speaking at a media preview event on June 1, she pointed to the glass bridge connecting the almost 150-year-old red brick building to a new four-floor structure that reveals the Jewish history of the Washington area, home to nearly 300,000 Jews today, according to official estimates. That bridge, literally and figuratively, connects the past to the present and into the future, she said. Ivy L. Barsky, the museum's executive director, said the 32,500-square-foot museum, which cost $31 million, also can serve as a bridge to both the secular and religious aspects of Judaism, for the devout and the non-devout alike. We know that a lot of people and a lot of Jews and a lot of young Jewish folks in Washington and elsewhere really connect to their history and heritage in places like ours, she said. We're not about prayer, but I think people get really curious and get answers about Jewishness, to a certain extent, Judaism, and museums tend to be really unthreatening, safe places to get that information. The museum will house a collection rooted in the archive of the former Jewish Historical Society of Greater Washington of more than 24,000 photographs and more than 1,000 objects. Among the artifacts on display are a matchbook signed by President Carter that was used at the first lighting of the National Menorah in 1977, a notebook with handwritten words of Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish Supreme Court justice, and the Seder plate used by President Obama's family while at the White House. Traditional items like mezuzahs, decorative containers on doorposts of Jewish homes that contain a small scroll with a prayer, are featured. One was on the door of the office of Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, on January 6. Another, a large silver version, was a gift to Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is on display in a special exhibition of Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the final location of a national tour that concludes on November 30. Special exhibitions, like the one about Ginsburg, will vary in cost, but the remainder of the museum is free. Though the overall museum highlights the broad culture of Washington Jews, it contains artifacts and stories of the famous and not so famous that relate to their faith, along with numerous other dimensions of their lives. On the museum's second floor, there are 12-by-12-inch cubes that include images of 100 Jewish people, each labeled with three words, such as the late Washingtonian Eugene Lippman, who was noted for being a rabbi, outspoken, and a resistor. Museum curators hope the soft, movable objects will lead visitors to reflect on their own multifaceted identities. Beyond the physical items like the cubes that visitors can touch and the objects they can view are the lesser-known tales of the Jewish people who've lived in the district for centuries. Foer noted that Ulysses S. Grant, then an Army general in the Civil War, signed an expulsion order for Jews in the South that President Lincoln halted. Years later, as U.S. president, Grant treated the Jews of Washington far differently. He accepted the invitation to attend the dedication of this brick building, said Foer, telling the story that is recounted in a video presentation in the History Sanctuary that includes three of the synagogue's original 1876 pews. He sat here for more than 3 hours in the heat, no air conditioning, and he even made a generous personal contribution. Barsky, the former CEO of the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia, said the museum will be giving a public face to stories like that. I'm a Jewish museum professional for more than 30 years, and I knew very little about the story of Jewish Washington until I got here. The museum features a timeline of Jewish history from 1790 to the present in an area where classrooms and a mikvah, or ritual bath, once were located. The door that previously gave access to the mikvah is among the artifacts on display there. On the floor above is a multimedia Seder table that offers visitors an opportunity to consider issues about justice and immigration, and an interactive map that allows them to search for synagogues or other points of interest over the centuries. That floor also includes the various facets of Jewish life, starting with worship and continuing with education, work, play, and food. It also highlights Jewish values such as conflict for the sake of heaven and repairing the world. Among the conflicts highlighted within the museum was a debate over the national menorah. One rabbi said it reflected the essential public display of Hanukkah candles. Another said it marked an unconstitutional government establishment of religion. Preserving those disagreements is important, said curator Sarah A. Levitt. We look at anti-Semitism, we look at abortion rights, we look at immigration rights, we look at voting rights, all of those ideas. How is that about repairing the world? We want visitors to think about those ideas. The museum also features a community hub where Levitt hopes visitors can think about what actions they might take after learning about D.C. Jewish history. That space features a large photo of a woman outside the U.S. Capitol at a rally protesting the Muslim travel ban, whose sign reads, "This is the moment I trained for in Hebrew school." Though the historic sanctuary is currently a place where museum goers can sit and watch a video presentation before moving on to interactive displays, museum officials said it can also become a space for lectures and rituals in the future. We restored the historic sanctuary in part because we wanted it to look as original as it could, but also so that it could be used, said Jonathan Edelman, collections curator. Barsky said private events, including some involving worship, are already planned. We've definitely had some conversations already with people who want to do that or who want to have a life cycle event or a Shabbat service and dinner or an Erev Rosh Hashanah service and dinner, she said. There are a few things already scheduled by outsiders. Our next article was published on June the 2nd and is entitled, "Virtual Worshippers Often Satisfied, But More Americans Choose In-Person Services," by Adele M. Banks. In the height of the pandemic, many Americans who attended in-person worship services turned to their computers and their couches instead for virtual viewing. Now, the Pew Research Center finds a third of Americans regularly attend in-person worship services, while a bit more than a quarter regularly watch religious services on TV or online. Its new survey paints a detailed picture of which, why, and how often Americans continue worshiping online or on TV. Half of those who are regular online watchers of religious services usually do so alone. More than half, 61%, of those who virtually attend do not participate in worship activities as they did in person, such as singing, kneeling, or praying out loud. But Black, 49%, and Hispanic, 47%, online worshipers are more likely to continue those practices virtually. And while the majority, 60%, of virtual viewers watch the worship service of one congregation, 32% watch those of two or more houses of worship, and 6% watch four or more different congregations. One quarter of regular online worshipers say they exclusively watch services of the congregation they usually attend. Regular attenders were defined as those who said they watched or attended services in the month before the survey, or had attended or watched at least monthly. The online survey of more than 11,000 Americans reports significant levels of satisfaction among those who are worshiping online. Broadly speaking, the survey finds that most Americans who watch religious services on screens are happy with them, states the report, which was released on June the 2nd. Two-thirds of U.S. adults who regularly stream religious services online or watch them on TV say they are either extremely satisfied or very satisfied with the services they see. A similar share of U.S. adults, 68%, say they are extremely or very satisfied with the sermons, and a bit more than half say they're also quite satisfied with the music they hear at worship services they view online or on TV. Still, a larger share of U.S. adults express significant satisfaction with aspects of in-person worship, with 74% of those who attend in person saying they are very or extremely satisfied with the sermons, and 69% saying the same about the music. Researchers delved into the nuances of religion and technology to report on the state of virtual and in-person worship in a survey taken in November, after the pandemic had waned, but before the end of the national health emergency. The top major reason adults say they watch religious services online is because they're convenient. While 43% of regular virtual viewers cite convenience, just a quarter cite safety, specifically a concern about contracting or spreading COVID-19 or other diseases. But COVID remains a factor for some Americans who say they attend in-person services less often than they did before the pandemic. While 21% of these frequent attenders say they found other ways to pursue spiritual interest, an almost equal percentage, 20%, said, "I am still worried about COVID-19. There also is a distinct difference in the feelings of connection depending on whether Americans worship online or in person. About two-thirds of regular in-person attenders say they feel quite a bit or a great deal of connection with other attenders, choosing the highest two options on a 5-point scale. Just 28% of regular virtual viewers report the same sense of connection with in-person attenders while they, the virtual participants, are watching. And a somewhat smaller percentage, 22, of virtual observers say they feel a strong connection to others watching virtually. Of the quarter or so Americans who continue to use screens to take part in worship services, three-quarters say they prefer the in-person experience, compared with 11% who prefer watching on TV or online, and 14% who say they don't have a preference. Among the people who are most likely to watch church services virtually are members of historically Black Protestant denominations. Nearly 6 in 10, 58%, say they watch online at least monthly or did so in the month before the survey, compared with 47% of evangelicals, 28% of mainline Protestants, 24% of Catholics, and 19% of Jews. 2 in 10 of these Black Protestants solely watch remotely via screens. 37% attend virtually and in person, and more than 1 in 10, 13%, say they are in-person attenders who don't regularly choose to watch virtual services. Black Protestant church members also are more likely than viewers of some other faiths to say they feel like active participants in services they're watching virtually. They also were the group with the largest percentage, 25%, of people who watch services of another congregation, in addition to or other than their own. Members of historically black Protestant churches, 37%, along with evangelical Protestants, 28%, are the most likely to engage at least weekly in religious technology, including apps for prayer or scripture, or religious study groups. About 12% of Catholics, Jews, and mainline Protestants are considered heavy users of religious technology. Other findings of the survey on religion and technology included 30% of U.S. adults say they use online search to gain religious information. 21% use websites or apps to help them read the Bible and other scriptures. 15% listen to podcasts focused on religion. 14% use websites or apps as reminders to pray. More than half of the U.S. adults, 54%, say they never use apps for prayer, scripture study, or religious information, nor do they listen to religious podcasts. Our next article was published on June the 1st and is entitled Large Conventions Resume for Jehovah's Witnesses by Alejandra Molina, Los Angeles. Nearly a year after Jehovah's Witnesses resumed their trademark door-to-door preaching, adherents of the faith will convene in person for one of their largest conventions after a three-year pandemic pause. Kingdom Halls, where congregants typically meet twice a week, reopened for in-person worship in April 2022. In September, door knocking resumed. Now, beginning June the 2nd, the three-day gathering, centered on the theme of patience, was to be held at the Long Beach Arena in Los Angeles County. Conventions are an important part of the culture of the global denomination of 8.6 million. The Long Beach event is just the first of 12 Jehovah's Witnesses conventions to take place at the arena this summer. And some 6,000 conventions will be held worldwide as part of this year's Exercise Patience Convention Series. Leaders expect about 80,000 attendees to attend the summer conventions in Long Beach. In the U.S., more than 700 Jehovah's Witnesses conventions will be held in 144 host cities. But the Long Beach Arena is one of the largest venues that Jehovah's Witnesses use in the United States, said Jean Beltran, a regional spokesperson for Jehovah's Witnesses. Beltran said thousands of volunteers gathered at the arena to help clean the venue before the start of the convention. "There's an exuberance among Jehovah's Witnesses that is so palpable," Beltran told RNS. While congregants can now engage with others with their public ministries and at regular services, Beltran said, "There's a lot of excitement about being back at a large venue. The lessons discussed in convention sessions are drawn from the Bible." In Long Beach, symposiums were planned to touch on building friendships, growing spiritually, and reaching goals. A live baptism was to be performed Saturday morning, and a pre-recorded drama featured in two parts during the weekend afternoon sessions. In the wake of the pandemic, witnesses shut their kingdom halls, suspended door knocking, and canceled hundreds of in-person summer worship conventions in cities across the United States. When they canceled close to 800 conventions in 2020, it was the first time since 1897 that they had not held their in-person conventions. The year before the pandemic, in 2019, they held 5,752 worldwide conventions, including a meeting of 40,000 witnesses in Phoenix. That contributed an estimated $60 million to the local economy. Our last article was published on May 30th and is entitled Women of Welcome: Looks to Evangelical Women to Change the Conversation on Immigration, by Emily McFarlane Miller. Sarah Jackson remembers being pregnant with her second child in 2014 and hearing stories about gangs of immigrants coming across the border and attacking ranches in New Mexico or something. Those stories made Jackson, who now has three children between the ages of 3 and 10, one of whom she and her husband adopted from foster care, feel fearful as a mom. But none of that seemed to fit with her evangelical faith, which she said taught her that Christians are called to be wrung out for one another. Then she encountered Women of Welcome. What I learned really felt more in line with where my heart is with foster care, where I just feel like Christians are called to compassion and to do something, she said. Women of Welcome is a collaborative partnership between the National Immigration Forum and World Relief, one of six faith-based agencies contracted with the U.S. government to resettle refugees in the country, aiming to help evangelical women understand immigration and refugee resettlement from a biblical perspective. As attention turns to the border with the end of Title 42 and with new policies restricting U.S. entry for asylum seekers, the head of the organization says she believes these women are changing the conversation among evangelicals. This is why I'm confident that this community of women is going to change the dynamic in the immigration space. I'm 100% sure of it because of the women who are in our community and the growth that has happened with the women in the community, said Bree Stensrud, director of Women of Welcome. The organization was founded in 2017 after rhetoric around immigrants and refugees became inflamed and dehumanizing during former President Donald Trump's first campaign for office, Stensrud said. Previous polling by Lifeway Research showed evangelicals' views about immigration were being shaped more by the media than by the Bible, she pointed out. Research also showed evangelical women were more supportive than their male counterparts of policies impacting immigrants and refugees, said Matthew Sorens, U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. Women also expressed more ambiguity, voicing concerns about security alongside values like hospitality and compassion, Sorens said. Plus, said Jenny Murray, President and CEO of the National Immigration Forum, it's really clear that what's very important in many evangelical communities and the glue that often brings together really wonderful efforts are the women that lead those efforts. Many connect care for immigrants and refugees with their beliefs about protecting life or with support for children in foster care, Murray said. Nobody was speaking to those women, according to Stensrud. So Women of Welcome created a free Bible study looking at immigration through the story of Ruth and Naomi in the biblical book of Ruth. To date, it has been downloaded more than 135,000 times, she said. In addition to creating free Bible studies done by many and in-person Bible study groups across the country, Women of Welcome has gathered women in an online community and curated immersive visits to partners on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. Its community is mostly conservative to moderate, both theologically and politically, and strictly nonpartisan, Stensrud said. A number of Christian influencers have also joined the organization on trips to the border, like author Anne Voskamp and Latasha Morrison of Be the Bridge. In the years since Women of Welcome began, Stensrud said, she's seen women who once supported a ban on travel to the U.S. from Muslim-majority countries now collecting items such as tea kettles and thermoses to welcome Afghan women and make them feel at home in the country. She's also been encouraged to see an increase in the number of evangelicals reporting the Bible as the top influence on their thinking regarding immigration, up from 12% in 2015 to 20% in 2022. You start to see what God is doing in stirring the hearts and minds of his people toward vulnerable people. And I do think change is possible, Stensrud said. I do think that women truly want to help, and they want to love people well, but they do need people to acknowledge what they fear, and they do need someone to give them a different narrative. Jackson first learned about Women of Welcome in 2019, when she was seated with Stensrud at a benefit for a homeless shelter in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where she attends New Life Church, she said. Jackson wasn't sure how she felt about immigration at the time, but she started following Stensrud online, then Women of Welcome. She joined the organization's private Facebook group, where women were clearing out Amazon list of needed items for refugee children and encouraging one another to maintain a compassionate approach to the topic of immigration and refugee resettlement. For Jackson, who works in women's ministry at her church and directs women's conferences at a camp in California, it was a huge encouragement to see Christian women living out what she read in the Bible about caring for the refugee and the foreigner, she said. Women of Welcome has made her more aware of policy issues she might be voting on and opportunities to talk to her representatives. She said she's also begun to have more conversations with friends and family members, all fellow Christians, urging them to look at immigration and refugee resettlement through the lens of their faith. Last summer, Jackson joined a group of women traveling to the border for 4 days. It was a short trip. Being gone for 3 bedtimes is pretty hard, she noted, but it made an impact. She said she found herself ugly crying more than once. I went into the trip knowing that I would be really impacted emotionally by this, but I really appreciated how they engaged us intellectually, she said. A policy expert walked the group through the history of immigration and asylum seeking. In the U.S., she learned that seeking asylum is a right and a legal process, and found it kind of infuriating that we're not allowing them to do it. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.